from the Sky News Centre at 6. As one of David Cameron's most trusted advisers, Lord Young has been forced to quit after claiming the country has never had it so good. In an extraordinary interview with the Daily Telegraph, he dismissed what he described as the so-called recession and said most people are actually better off because of it. Mark Littlewood from the Institute of Economic Affairs has some sympathy.
Some of it was phrased very badly, referring to the recession as the so-called recession. Seemed to me a rather strange thing to do. But nevertheless, in the round, he makes some very good points.
All flights at Birmingham Airport have been suspended after two people were injured in a crash involving a light aircraft. Eyewitnesses reported seeing smoke coming from the plane, which is thought to have had problems landing in fog. On board was a liver needed for a human transplant operation. Chief Inspector Matt Markham from West Midlands Police explains what happened.
There was a small fire within the aircraft. Two people on board the plane. One we believe is serious condition, who's been airlifted to hospital, and the second one has been taken to hospital, but with less significant injuries.
The man found dying in the back of a van in Berkshire has been named by police as father of three, Shalim Amar. The 40-year-old died from head injuries. Four men are being questioned in connection with the murder inquiry. Falkirk MP Eric Joyce has been banned from driving for a year. The Labour politician admitted failing to provide a specimen to police after being stopped on suspicion of drink driving. The head of football's world governing body is playing down fears England's bid to host the 2018 World Cup is in trouble because of a story printed in a British newspaper. Two top FIFA officials have been suspended after being accused of corruption. And Strictly Come Dancing star Matt Baker has become favourite to take over as the One Show host. Married comedian Jason Manford quit the position last night just 4 months into the job after admitting he'd been flirting with fans online. That's the latest. I'm Kelly Withers.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with old Labour economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Anti-nuclear campaigners in Thornbury and surrounding area will be here in a little while as they're bringing together nuclear experts from around the country next weekend for a fact-finding conference. The aim is to get a clear idea of what new nuclear build will mean for the southwest Gloucestershire and the surrounding area. And also next weekend, practical skills and inspiring ideas for sustainable living in 21st century Bristol. That's how Sunday week's Big Shift Day Laylong event at the Council House is billed. And everything's up for discussion. There'll be sessions on energy, urban and rural agriculture, local currencies, new approaches to work and jobs, transport and healthcare. So we ask, what is the big shift? And we focus down on the issue of local money systems. But first, how is Lord Chancellor and Justice Secretary Kenneth Clark's proposed change to legal aid going to affect access to justice here in Bristol? With me is Solicitor John Peake from South West Law on Old Market, who do a lot of legal aid work. Hi, John, and welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening.
Now, first of all, this is a $2 billion annual budget for legal aid that's being cut here. Surely it's a fantastic amount of money to be spending on legal aid. And as we've been told by Ken Clark, we've got one of the most comprehensive legal aid services in the world. That means we're spending money on legal aid that hardly any other country in the world is.
That's not entirely true, and it's a slightly distorted view of the reality. In fact, although a lot of money is spent on the legal aid system, that largely reflects the justice system in the UK, which is significantly different from those in most of the European countries, and therefore you're really not comparing like with like.
Now, this current system we've got was introduced apparently way back in 1949. Surely it's about time we brought it up to date.
The system has been under pretty much continual change, certainly over the last 15 to 20 years, with a number of different initiatives being introduced by the governments over the years. Only last week, the most recent of the changes was introduced, which came about following on from the Labour government's desire to try and control the amount of spending on legal aid.
Now, one of the problems with this whole announcement was that it was made on Monday in the House of Commons rather than Thursday. A lot of the people who were campaigning around it, particularly political parties, were gearing up for an announcement on Thursday, and actually it came on Monday, which kind of wrong-footed some people. But what's been the reaction amongst lawyers in Bristol to this announcement?
The almost unanimous reaction is one of horror and concern. At the end of the day, the proposals are likely to impact significantly on the rights of individuals, and not those who are particularly well off, but those who are most in need of help.
Now, we were hearing earlier on from John Keeley that actually, for example, in issues like employment, it's much easier to just simply let people present their own cases at these employment tribunals, and they don't really need legal aid.
I think that's a fairly simplistic view. What you have to understand is that most employment cases, there is an individual who may have been dismissed, may have been discriminated against, who is taking his or her former company to the tribunal. That company is almost always legally represented, may well have senior solicitors or barristers in the tribunal, and there's a clear disparity of effective representation in that forum.
Now, what about cases of for clinical negligence? Again, isn't there a sort of a culture here, as Kenneth Clark was talking about on Monday in the House of Commons, where the first reaction of people is simply to go, right, I'm going to get myself a free lawyer?
No, my experience of clinical negligence work is that the first reaction of most people is to inquire what exactly has gone wrong. And if the health trust meets the concerns, addresses the concerns at that point, then quite often the case will not actually progress beyond that point.
So can you just give us an idea of the sort of scope of some lawyers do legal aid, some lawyers don't do legal aid? Obviously the whole of the law is separated into criminal law and civil law. Now, does this affect mostly civil law cases?
No, there will be an effect on the criminal lawyers, but I think the majority of the problems will be faced by those who do civil work, and in particular those who do what I would call the social welfare categories of work.
Now, surely what you're doing really is simply arguing for your own income. You're not really concerned about people out there on the street. You are there putting the case of lawyers.
I think Ken Clark made that very point and said that the Law Society, in objecting to the proposals, was merely representing the interests of its members. We as a firm do perhaps 85-90% legal aid work, and obviously if these cuts came in, then it would represent a massive problem for us, but you know, we will counter that as and when. But our real concern is that at the moment we help perhaps somewhere in the region of 2,000 people a year. And if we're not there, then the reality is that there will be nobody there to do the work in our place.
But surely they can simply represent themselves in court?
That really betrays a naivety about the system. My two areas of specialism are education work and welfare benefits work. And the welfare benefits work in particular is massively legally complex, regulation heavy, and it would be almost impossible for most people, particularly you know, those who may have struggled at school, to understand the legislation and the rules that are being applied.
Now, you mentioned the Law Society there that represents solicitors. Des Hudson from the Solicitors' Union, I mean, effectively a Solicitors' Union, the Law Society, was on the BBC on Monday, and he had a chance to put his questions directly to Justice Secretary Ken Clark.
From tomorrow, what is it the government is planning for somebody to get access to justice if they're not rich and mighty? Let me give you an example. Let's say that you're the relative of someone who had the misfortune to be treated in Stafford Hospital, and your aunt or your father or your partner was injured or killed, and you're not very rich. How does Ken Clark suggest that that person will get access to justice?
That person will get access to justice by using the no-win, no-fee arrangement we now have in this country, which is how a very large number of criminal negligence cases are brought at the moment.
Which you're changing.
We're changing it to make it just less grossly expensive. That's on the advice of a judge who carried out a proper report on it at the request of the Master of the Rolls. I agree with Sir Rupert Jackson that the present system is costly, reduces, you know, defendants face enormous bills, it's very formidable for people, and we're going for a more straightforward and less costly way of having no-win, no-fee cases brought, which I think will be the normal way of bringing a claim for damages for clinical negligence or any other form of negligence. At the moment, some are legal aid, some are no-win, no-fee. As reformed along the lines that Lord Justice Jackson's recommended, no win, no fee is what I'd say to the President of the Law Society is the route he should explore for any client he turns up that he's describing.
So big changes for people fighting clinical negligence, big changes for people going through messy divorces.
So, yes, so that's the no-win, no-fee proposals. What do you think about those, John? Is that realistic of Ken to say that if people are involved in negligence cases, actually that they need to do is find a no-win, no-fee lawyer?
No, no-win, no-fee has become increasingly common in the UK over the last few years. Clinical negligence work doesn't really lend itself particularly well to no-win, no-fee, because insurance companies who normally back these cases can be quite reluctant to do so. The other thing which Ken Clark was quiet about when he was saying that was that at the moment, most conditional fee cases, no-win, no-fee cases, are dealt with on the basis that the solicitor will receive a success fee, effectively compensation for the risk that they're running in taking on a case where they may not get paid at the end of it. At the moment, that success fee is being paid by the insurance company who meets the individual's claim, so there is no deduction from the claimant's compensation. One of the changes that Jackson is proposing, which appears to be welcomed by Ken Clark, is that that success fee will actually come out of the compensation and therefore reduce the amount of compensation paid to the individual.
Now, could you just give us an idea at your practice of a typical day in court? What's the sort of cases? I mean, you've already been through some of them, but give us an idea of not going into details about a specific case, but the kind of cases you're bringing to court and the kind of people that are coming to you that simply can't afford without legal aid to get legal representation.
We do a lot of housing work, and we only act on behalf of tenants, and we're therefore often in court against the city council or other social landlords. Invariably, it will be cases where people have got into arrears with their rent and the local authority is seeking an order for eviction. We act for people who want to bring claims based on disrepair where the conditions they're living in are absolutely appalling. And of course, one of the things that the changes are suggesting is that legal aid will not be available for those disrepair cases.
So what is that actually going to mean for people if they're in that sort of situation? Does it just simply mean that they will not have the knowledge and they will not have the representation to fight their case?
I think that's right. I think there's a very real risk of that happening. Another example I'd like to give relates to benefit tribunals, because the figures show that when somebody actually has the benefit of advice or representation, then the chances of a successful benefits appeal go up to something in the region of 70% to 80%. And that reflects on how complex the system is and why specialist input is needed.
And what are these people going to be able to do in the future when legal aid is taken away from them?
Our concern is that they may try and handle the cases themselves. And as I say, the chances of success in that situation are massively reduced.
Now, the main thrust of the reforms is to rein back, according to Ken Clark, the litigious society. And here he is again on the BBC.
Make cuts. Cannot carry on financing the litigious society on the scale that we are. And I'm glad to say that there was no serious opposition to that from any member of the Parliament this afternoon, because everybody's got to agree make cuts somewhere, and the vastly inflated level of legal aid spending in this country is an obvious place to start.
Well, there you have it from the horse's mouth. There's no criticism, virtually no criticism of what he was proposing in the Houses of Parliament on Monday, John.
We were pretty horrified at the lack of any form of criticism by the Labour opposition to the government proposals. That seemed to be a fairly wanton disregard for their responsibilities.
Martin, as an old Labour economist, not necessarily a lawyer, would you like to give an explanation as to why? I mean, we've heard a lot of criticism again this week of your favourite, who you voted for, Ed Miliband's leadership of the party, and also the Shadow Justice Secretary's performance on Monday was very lacklustre.
Well, I'm not going to defend the Labour leadership. I don't think as I'm responsible for what they do. I'm very much a foot soldier.
Well, I think you are, because you voted for Ed.
Well, I think the main point I would make is two points. One, cutting public expenditure as a whole is actually a foolish manoeuvre, as the Irish are finding out, and as everybody in Britain will understand in 6 months' time. So all of this masochism is actually unnecessary. Secondly, of course, I've just been reading about home foreclosures in the United States, where in actual fact it looks as if the banks have not actually got the documentation which proves that they own the properties that they're repossessing, but these basically fraudulent cases are being nodded through by corrupt judges all over the US with no challenge from the victims.
Well, this is very relevant to what you were saying just now, John.
There have been a few challenges to these to the paperwork, and it's actually the challenges being made actually put in doubt whether the collateralized debt obligation that we've come to know and love is in fact a legal document at all, because they haven't actually done all the paperwork. And this, of course, really will mean that the banks really are insolvent. All the CDOs they are holding are not enforceable in court.
Well, this is rather
and therefore
worrying.
Are worth nothing.
This is rather worrying, John, isn't it? You were saying you do a lot of housing work, and it sounds to me as if it may be that possible cases which may be possibly successfully challenged are simply not going to be challenged because people don't have access to justice.
There is a very real risk of that happening. Yes, that's right.
Okay, so what about debt and housing? Martin, you were involved in Bristol Debt Advice Centre. This is another area which is going to be taken away. You mentioned it briefly in the first half. How is it actually going to affect somebody who's in debt? Surely, I mean, if you're in debt, that's just it. You've got a big credit card bill and there's nothing you can do
about
it.
Well, I mean, debt advice and housing advice is now given through the civil legal aid budget. Now, if they're going to cut the civil legal aid budget, then they need to find another means of giving debt advice, on funding debt advice, because debt advice is actually a cutting-edge intervention in the economy at this stage. What I was researching at the Bristol Debt Advice Centre was the whole question of people not paying their council tax, because that's usually a trigger that they've actually got other debt problems. And instead of waiting for people to be flushed out of the woodwork, they need to be identified at an early stage and given proactive help. This is not something that we should be cutting back on. It's something we should be expanding. Yeah. Now, what it seems that Kenneth Clark's talking about when he's talking about the legal system is, as we all know, that there are celebrities suing each other in the courts every week, and that's what people imagine is the legal system. But the legal system is also these tribunals where people's housing are decided and so on. And I don't really know enough about how the legal aid system works. I mean, what John Keeley was saying earlier is that some immigration lawyers are basically abusing the system or whatever, but it seems to me that if the system's being abused, then the system needs to be reformed. Cutting benefits to people who are entitled to them is A, unwise, and B, it may be illegal. I mean, it may be that the people are entitled to have this support, and it's not very much, it's not for the government to say whether they should or shouldn't have it.
Well, John, talking about immigration, I mean, surely what Kenneth Clark's doing is rather sensible. He's saying that actually, if people are asylum seekers or refugees, they will be helped, but those who are just potentially anyway economic migrants won't be helped.
There's a fundamental tenet of the UK legal system, which is that everybody should be equal before the law, and this implies that there will be at the very least a two-tier system, and that somebody who may have an entirely legitimate legal case because of their immigration status will not have the same rights of access to justice as somebody else, and that cannot be right.
What would you mean by immigration status?
You may have somebody here who, let's say, is, for want of a better description, an economic migrant who's here from another EU country and who is working over here. Well, the suggestion is that they would not necessarily have the same rights that somebody who is an asylum seeker does have.
And is that the sort of case you deal with quite a lot in your practice? Are you you're able to actually bring justice, or at least take cases for people who are economic migrants?
We tend to act, in fact, for more asylum seekers than economic migrants. But certainly we are concerned that if the changes do come in, then there will be a section of our client base who will not be able to get access.
But aren't you simply just going to have to take this on the chin? There's cuts taking place right across the board, and actually it's important that some cuts are taken in justice and legal services, and this is just your slice of the cake that you're just going to have to simply accept.
The legal system ought to be a means of promoting equality. Our concern is that the system that's been proposed by Glenn Clark is a mechanism for dealing with crises when they arrive, rather than necessarily trying to avert the crisis arising in the first place. And that can't be right. It can't be right that somebody who is having difficulty claiming benefits, therefore runs into debt trouble, runs into problems with their rent and therefore loses their house. And it's a chain of events that, if it's dealt with early enough, can be prevented. And in only allowing funding for the very last stage of that process, most of the other problems won't get dealt with properly.
So what is this going to mean in, you know, in this sort of 6 months, in a year's time? I mean, how is it going to sort of change the shape of what goes on in our courts?
I think the change, if it happens as is being proposed, is going to be substantial. As I say, we as a firm do somewhere in the region, act for somewhere in the region of 2,000 people each year. The vast majority of those people will either go without advice and help, or will have to go along to the Citizens Advice Bureau, which just is not going to be able to cope with that influx.
Well, we've seen quite a lot of times over the last few months, we've had the explanation has been, after as a result of these changes, as a result of these cuts, you're going to have to go down to the Citizens Advice Bureau. I would imagine that they may well be snowed under.
Well, they're already being snowed under. There was a study done by the New Economics Foundation a couple of years ago now, which was actually arguing not for increasing the legal aid budget, but for spending it more rationally, and exactly in the way that's been described, by picking up problems early. Most legal problems are a result of failure of some bureaucratic system prior to the legal problem emerging. And if we could actually proactively make sure that people get, you know, for example, all the appeals that asylum seekers have to go through, if they get it right the first time, then you wouldn't need to have the appeals, would you? And this is the way you could actually make the system more efficient, but without cutting. We do need a legal aid system. Don't forget, all of these transfer payments like legal aid keep the economy afloat in a depression. And if you cut them back, you don't, in fact, help your economy at all.
So, John, what would you suggest for anyone who is expecting justice, expecting to be able to have access to justice, and then just simply finds that there is no funding for a solicitor? What would you suggest for people?
Well, the first thing to say is that at this stage, it's only a green paper. It's only a proposal. It's up for consultation and people have to respond, but I think it's the middle of March. Only when the white paper is subsequently published are we going to know the extent of the potential horrors that we might face. Hopefully, by lobbying, by speaking to MPs, councillors, the government will actually realise that it's doing itself and the community a disservice. I really cannot see that the proposals fit within the big society ideal as proposed by David Cameron. There will be a big society, but it's going to be a big society of people who don't have access to justice.
Thanks very much, John Peake, from firm Southwest Law, based in Old Market. And in a minute, we'll be having a discussion about monetary reform. But before that, some music.
I'm winning!
Well, that's the Caravans, featuring Inez Andrews and Albertina Walker. She's very, very patient, and she's willing to wait. From the CD, which is A Rough Guide to Gospel. Anyway, I'm now joined by a couple of monetary reformers. On Sunday week, the 28th of November, that is, Bristol Council House will be buzzing with people who believe we need big changes to the way we do things if Bristol and Britain is to survive as a, I suppose, what you could call post-industrial country. That's not to say there will and cannot be industry, simply that the gap between jobs available and the jobs needed is getting wider and wider all the time, and we need to address the lack of money for so many people in society. And I'm joined now by Chris Sunderland. He's involved in a local currency scheme. Hi, Chris, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi.
Now, Chris, can you tell us what is a local currency scheme, and what is this one particularly that you're involved with?
Okay, I'm director of the Bristol and Bath Local Currency Scheme, we're calling it. Our idea is simply to create a local money. Some people can't understand there could possibly be an alternative to sterling, but I think it's becoming apparent that we need to strengthen our local economies. We need to do much more things locally. We need to work towards a low energy, lower carbon economy. And one of the ways to do this is to actually privilege local trade by having a currency that is specifically works with locally owned businesses.
Now, I imagine the European Union won't be very happy with you because they like to make sure that countries from all over the place can bid for local contracts, and also they'd like to try and make sure that trade is wide open.
Yes, EU competition laws are a real problem for anybody who wants to make sure that local people get local jobs. We actually think confronting that's really important. Many people are saying, and there are now public policies, that one needs to consider other things than simply the financial bottom line.
But at the end of the day, your currency, your local currency, have you got a name for it?
No, we'll reserve the name because actually the name's really important. But we're thinking of publishing a Bristol pound note and a Bath pound note, and having an electronic system underneath both the notes so that people can make electronic payments and web-based payments, so the thing can have some real depth in the local economy.
But one of the reasons that some of these local exchange and trading systems haven't taken off in the past is because they're not good for things like buying very basic commodities, like, you know, paying your water bill, paying your council tax bill, and buying petrol. So how are you going to, you know, get it integrated into some of the most fundamental things that many people spend their money on?
Well, you're right. There are note systems in Totnes, Brixton, Lewis, Stroud. They've all been really effective in advertising local businesses, and you know, national media has covered the launch of the notes. But in order to have a significant effect on the local economy, you've got to have scale and you've got to have depth. So for that reason, we're going to launch over the whole of the former Avon, so that's 1 million people. We're going to do an electronic and web-based payment system because that's how most people are doing lots of their transactions. And we're going to try and involve the big institutions from the start. So we're actually talking to Bristol City Council about procuring services in local money and receiving payments in local money.
Now, you're speaking at this event next weekend. Can you tell us, what is Shift Bristol?
Actually, Kieran Mundy is speaking.
Oh, right, sorry.
At Shift Bristol. But Shift Bristol is a whole set of ideas, people and ideas, around how do we move to a low-carbon, much more energy-efficient, resilient local economy. And local currency is part of that. I mean, another thing that I'm involved in personally is community-supported agriculture, and so we'll be launching Sims Hill Shared Harvest, which is a new community venture in Bristol around local food, about a community getting together with growers to grow their own food on some land actually next to the M32.
Well, that's quite timely, because I was just reading this week that there are predictions from one of these big international bodies that there could be a food crisis next year.
Well, we have to source much more of our food locally. It is absolutely stupid that you know, all our fruits coming from Guatemala and wherever. We should be getting much more of our food from our local city region. And there are those who are setting out to begin to make this happen. It is only a beginning, but it's a big change that's got to happen.
Now, I'm also joined by Ben Curtis, who's one of the authors of this Bank of England Creation of Currency Bill 2010. Hi, Ben, and welcome to Drive Time again.
Hi, Tony.
Now, you had a conference last weekend, didn't you, about the Bank of England bill and about monetary reform generally in London, I believe. Can you just tell us how that went and what was being discussed at the student conference?
It was generally a great success. We organised the conference in association with the New Economics Foundation, and we had a number of speakers from the Cobden Centre who represent a more libertarian view of the money system. So We had 130 spaces, and we managed to sell out full 3 weeks before the conference, making it, to my knowledge, the largest monetary reform conference that's ever been held. Most of the participants were students. We had a number of speakers, including Toby Baxendale, who is the owner of the largest supplier of fresh meat and fish to UK restaurants, and an Austrian economist. Steve Baker, MP, who's an MP from the Conservative Party, also a member of the Cobden Centre. Tim Evans, also from the Cobden Centre. Josh Ryan Collins, who was involved with the Brixton Pound and is a member of the New Economics Foundation, gave a very useful talk. Professor Mary Meller, who is Emeritus Professor at Northumbria University, gave us a talk on some of the solutions to the monetary problem, particularly from a community and more of a left-wing approach, and Toby Baxendale covered things from a right-wing approach, the dichotomy being that one side believes that the state is responsible for the mess that we're in, and the other side believes that it's the banks that are responsible.
So did you come to any conclusion about that? Is it the state or the banks?
We personally sit somewhere in the middle. The fractional reserve system would probably fall apart very quickly if there wasn't any state deposit guarantees, for instance, any state support and bailouts and so on. On the other side of things, looking back to the 1844 Bank Charter Act, which is where the private bank money system and the state money system became integrated so that banks could create the state currency. Realistically, looking back, I'm sure it wasn't entirely the state's fault, and looking back into the subprime crisis and so on, it's not entirely the bank's fault either. It's a complicated situation, so we try and take a kind of a neutral approach, so it's probably a bit of both, really.
Now, you had Steve Baxter, MP, you were saying there, who's a Conservative.
Baker, yes.
Baker. Does he have the ear of George Osborne?
He's a new MP, so he's the Conservative MP.
He hasn't worked his way up the tree yet, I suppose.
No, he likes to call himself an honest politician who's not in it for the career. He's in it to try and make a difference. And one interesting thing that he's already done so far in association with Douglas Carswell, who's another slightly longer serving Conservative MP, is they've just put through a private members bill in Parliament to try and implement a full reserve banking system with property rights for demand deposits actually returned to the depositors and no longer the property of the bank, effectively stopping the fractional reserve system. And the second reading of that was today, in fact, but I believe that there wasn't time for it because one of the earlier bills in the day managed to be taken up by government.
Something more important, obviously. anyway, what's your thoughts on these local exchange and trading systems that Chris here is doing? Because you're effectively trying to campaign to change the present system, aren't you?
Well, yeah, we're trying to campaign to completely change the fractional reserve system and move over to a full reserve system.
Now, you mentioned fractional reserve before. What is fractional reserve banking?
Fractional reserve banking, in its the simplest possible description, is probably that the banks are responsible for creating 97% of the money that we use, and the sole way that they do this is through debt. So if you imagine when you take a loan out of a bank, then to quote Paul Tucker, who's the Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, banks create loans simply by increasing the borrowing customer's current account. That is, they literally write the money into your account. Now, the implications of this are quite wide-reaching, but one of the most important ones is that for anybody to have a positive bank balance, somebody must have a negative bank balance to the equal amount. If all money is created as debt, then the only way you can get yourself out of debt is by somebody else going further into debt. Now, combined with the interest payments on this money that's being created out of nothing, a person or an economy must continually get itself into more and more debt, and there's no end to it. There's only a certain amount of people, and when there is an end that's kind of reached by physical limitations, then you have a crash, as we did in 2007 and 2008.
Well, this is this concept that we had Bill Steele talking about here a few weeks ago, which is called debt saturation, and that is when the debt is so massive that no amount of taxing or no amount of trying to service that debt is going to actually do anything with it. In the debt, it becomes so big that it's actually bigger than the amounts of money which are being spent in public spending, for example. So, I mean, what is your answer to something like debt saturation, where the debt has become so big that it's just impossible to service it anymore?
Yeah, you're quite right. There's a situation where an economy can come to where everybody's in so much debt that after the interest payments, there's not enough money left to buy the food. So obviously you have to take your priorities and start buying food instead of paying off your interest.
So how does your Bank of England, Bill, deal with that?
Effectively, we would... there wouldn't be a requirement for the economy to get into more debt to grow. And as I said before, if you think of the baseline amount of money being close to zero, as 97% of money is created as debt, there isn't any constantly circulating money in existence. So if the money is created as debt, when you pay off all of your debt, there's no money left. So this creates a situation whereby all of our policies and all of our economic incentives are driven towards getting into more and more debt. So the way that you replace this is by creating money that's constantly in circulation. And one way that you could do this is by transferring the rights of demand deposits back to the depositors. So
what is a demand deposit?
A demand deposit is any deposit with a bank that you can take out on demand. So for instance, a current account. Now what happens with the current account is your money is actually not in the bank in a digital safe, for instance. It's classed as a liability, so the bank owes you this money to be withdrawn on demand. But at the same time as lending you this money, or owing you this money, they allow you to spend it through the payment system. This is quite a complex thing that's...
Yeah, it sounds.
So the payment system means that a bank can owe you this money and say if I transferred some money over to your bank account, what would actually happen in real terms is, say it was £1,000, then £1,000 would move from my bank's account at the Bank of England over to your bank's account at the Bank of England. All that our banks would do is raise your account by £1,000 and lower mine by £1,000. Now, what the banks rely on is that somewhere else in the economy, somebody from your bank is going to be paying somebody from my bank £1,000. So what then happens is that this cancels out, and through the clearing system, neither bank has to transfer any actual money to each other. So the way that this is all set up allows for banks to go and invest our money. In return for your money not being safe in the bank, money in the bank, then you receive something like 0.1% interest a year, and that doesn't seem very fair to us combined with all the other negative consequences of using this system.
Now, it sounds to me you two between you have got a kind of a pincer movement going on here, because you are looking at the current system and making that work. And Chris, what you're doing, you're just saying, well, the current system isn't working, so what we need is another system.
Right.
Do you find that there's actually quite a lot of agreement between you, even though you're taking such different approaches? Do you want to start,
well,
Chris?
Well, I mean, I would notice a lot of agreement with what Ben's saying. You know, what we're trying to do with our local currency is reconnect it with real goods and services. It's about money as a means of exchange. That is what, you know, that's the primary task of money. It's only... the way that we've got a terribly complicated system now about the way that we're creating money and through interest and debt, etc. It's now confused, foolish, and raping the earth, because we have to service the debt that we've created, and we can only do that by continual expansion. And we're running into the limitations of the earth with climate change, peak oil, and other such things. So, yes, I mean, I see local currency as reconnecting us with the reality of, if you like, the basic of what money is for, which is exchange for goods and services. And if we can recover that, then if the big system goes, suffers in whatever way, then we have some sort of system to go back on. It's interesting if you go back to somewhere like Argentina, when their currency fell, what happened?
This was, I think, 2000 or 2001, wasn't it? Their complete collapse of the currency.
Well, 17.
And in fact, everybody's savings disappeared out of the banks and went to the IMF, which is rather irritating.
And 17 local currencies immediately sprang up in response to the collapse of the national currency, and because people had to trade, they had to do something.
So I suppose what we're doing is we're putting in place a resilient local system. We don't know what's going to happen, but Ben would tell us that it doesn't look good. So who knows? But it does seem sensible to have your own system of money, which you can exchange for products and services.
Now, Ben, your idea is really to have this money issued not as debt, spent straight into the economy by the government. But who would actually be in charge of that? Because I think a lot of people would scratch their heads and say, well, can we really trust the Treasury to do this job?
We would advocate that the only... For a start, the government wouldn't be solely responsible for creating new money. As part of the transition, everybody's demand deposits would become permanently circulating money. So there wouldn't really need to be a great deal of money injected into the system. And this is more of an academic debate that could be taken up at the Bank of England. So on one side, some people might say that the deflation that may happen, say if we had an increase in population and the amount of money circulating, there was less money per person. So in this instance, then, we may have deflation, which is where the prices of things go down, which may seem like a good thing, and it probably is if you've got a positive bank balance. But say that you became indebted before this happened and before the deflation occurred, the numerical value of your debt would stay the same. But in terms of purchasing power, it would be harder for you to pay off your debt if you, for instance, were receiving a lower wage. So this is something that may need to be tweaked by the system, and we've had it written into the Bank of England Act and our submission to the Independent Commission on Banking that effectively you would have a new monetary policy committee would be set up, and these people would decide whether deflation was happening and in which sectors of the economy based on economic data, which would be far easily measured when you had a permanently circulating money supply.
But the trouble is, Ben, that these banks have got a lot of power, and you, with your Bank of England Act, might be taking that power away. They're not going to like it, are they?
Well, they haven't said anything about it so far, so I guess we can cross that hurdle when we come to it.
Anyway, some commentators say that it's time to take the fight to the big Western investment banks, such as JP Morgan. And Max Kaiser on English language Freeview channel Russia Today has chosen to target a bank called JP Morgan. So why has Max decided that JP Morgan, the bank, the US investment bank, is fair game?
All of the short positions in silver are very concentrated in this one single entity of JP Morgan. Nobody knows for sure, but they reckon it's between 25 and 50% of all shorts in the silver market are held by JP Morgan.
Yes, and the reason why, again, is because both silver and gold, the manipulation of these two precious metals, are used by JP Morgan and HSBC and Goldman Sachs as a way to keep the dollar relatively high in value. And the US dollar is the means by which America imposes its imperium around the world. And they're guilty of war crimes, as we now know. Even George Bush in his book said, yeah, I'm guilty of war crimes. Yeah, I like waterboarding. So America is now the equivalent of Nazi Germany, as George Bush himself admits. He says, yeah, I'm Himmler. I'm Hitler. So what? What are you going to do about it? I tell you what we're going to do about it, George. We're going to put your little pet bank, JP Morgan, on the mat. They're done.
And that's Max Kaiser on Russia Today threatening to put JP Morgan on the mat, so to speak. Now, do you think there's any sense in what Max Kaiser's saying there, Ben, that actually by buying silver and that JP Morgan has invested massively in shorting silver, that actually this could bring down a bank? Is that feasible?
I can see it as being feasible. One of the interesting things about people buying gold and silver is that they're starting to lose faith in the monetary system altogether, which is quite worrying, really. So people are starting to massively invest in gold and silver, and a lot of people are starting to think of gold and silver as being the only really trustworthy store of value. Now, to some people, this might signify to them that they should start using gold and silver as money, and that money should be in fact backed by it. But I think that it's really important to actually analyse the situation in a more holistic manner, and to realise that although money and gold and silver are a decent store of value, they are still subject to the same problems with any commodity, really. Say somebody could invent a new superconductor involving gold, and then that would send the price of gold soaring. And obviously there's a finite amount of gold. It's not evenly geographically distributed across the world. And really the motivator for favouring the use of gold is that it's not subject to manipulation by either the government or the banking sector. Whereas it's quite easily proven that, as with the JP Morgan situation, that it is subject to speculation and price volatility.
Now, Chris, just remind us again about your group and when this talk is taking place, this Shift Bristol conference.
Sunday, November the 28th, in the Council House. Kieran Mundy will be talking about the Bristol and Bath local currency scheme. Other people will be presenting all sorts of things, from community supported agriculture through to just about everything to do with becoming a low carbon, energy efficient, resilient local economy.
Okay, and Ben, finally, your website, please, for your student conference and the Bank of England creation of currency bill 2010.
You can find our website at www.positivemoney.org.uk, and you can also sign up to support the campaign. We've got about 2,200 people in support of the campaign so far. Find us on Facebook, send us an email, and see how you can get involved if you'd like to.
Finally, I've got one sentence. I want you to tell me what you would do tonight if you were George Osborne.
Start looking at where the real problem lies.
Okay, lovely. Well, thanks very much, both of you, for joining us. Now, we're going to hear in a moment from the campaigner at Albury, and there is quite a big event happening next week in Thornbury, which is all to do with the proposed new nuclear power station at Albury. And I'm joined now by a couple of the campaigners. I wonder if you could just introduce yourself, please.
I'm Abigail Stewart-Menteith.
Okay, Abigail, can you tell us what the group's called?
We are Shepherdine Against Nuclear Energy.
And I see you have a big conference going on next weekend. That last one we were talking about was on Sunday in Bristol Council House, but this one is next Saturday, and that's at the Cosham Hall, Chapel Street in Thornbury. So what's going on at your conference, please?
We've got quite a few really very important speakers who are coming down to Thornbury to talk to us. We've got Professor Steve Thomas from Greenwich Business School. We've got Dr. Ian Fairley, who's an independent consultant on radioactivity and environment. He's done a lot of studies around leukemia, around nuclear power stations. We've got Professor Tom Burke, who's an internationally renowned environmentalist, who has also done a lot of consultants with international corporations, that sort of thing. We've also got research professor Andrew Blowers, and Professor Gareth Williams, who's also a local resident who's very anti-nuclear.
Okay, could you introduce yourself?
Yes, my name's Red Gillingworth. I'm the coordinator of the group, which is Shepherdine Against Nuclear Energy.
Now, I'm going to start off by asking you something quite controversial here. Now, are you not just worried about your property prices?
No, we are. Right, in our coalition of people, when you put a group together, a community group, you're going to have all different aspects of a spectrum, right? So, of course, we have some people who are concerned about property prices. We have also, the other extreme, people who are severely concerned about nuclear industry per se. And we cover the whole gambit of that.
Can you tell us what your main problem is then with the nuclear industry? Because many people are saying that this is actually the future, and you're kind of being like Luddites here.
No, this is that's a bit ridiculous, really, because this industry has been around for 50 years, right? It's not new technology. It's been around since 1950. Do you remember when nuclear first came around and there was a couple of bombs in Japan? Yeah. Well, so this isn't new technology. This is very old technology that hasn't developed very much.
You're comparing nuclear bombs there with a nuclear power station at Albury.
All I would say, right, I don't want to be extreme about this, but why do you think Iran wants a nuclear power station?
Well, because they're running out of oil, possibly.
Possibly, if they're running out of oil. Or maybe it may be a source for something else. Yeah.
Okay, so what exactly has been proposed at Albury? Maybe you could just tell us.
Well, I'll let Reg tell you a little bit more about the...
What, this event that we're proposing?
No, I
here?
Mean at the power station.
Oh, right, okay,
what,
yeah.
What's been proposed there?
Yeah, well, up to now, right.
Because this is a state-of-the-art nuclear power station we're being promised here.
Right, okay. I've done my research into this. There are only two nuclear reactors being built in Europe at the moment. One is at a place called Alkaloto in Finland, which I've personally been to. The other one is in Flamanville in northern France. Now, Alkaloto started in 2004. It was due for completion in 2009. Guess what? 2013 is now the date it's due to be finished. And it was supposed to be £3 billion. It's at least £6 billion now. Nuclear has never been brought in on time or on price historically.
Okay, so what do you think are the biggest concerns of local people who've joined your group?
Well, massive concerns about nuclear waste being stored on site for at least 150 years, which we haven't volunteered to have. It's just going to be imposed on our community down there.
Yeah, but surely there's a planning system to go through. The local authority gets involved. Everybody gets involved. And all the local people get a chance to put their point of view.
People get a chance to consult, right? And you know what consultation means? It doesn't mean being able to have your point of view heard or listened to. It means that you get heard. This is the issue that we're finding, is that DEC, the Department for Energy and Climate Change, have handed over responsibility for the consultation to the developers, who happen to be two German companies, E.ON and RWE.
So what, hang on a minute, you're saying that the consultation is being handled by the people who are actually want to build these power stations?
Correct, indeed, yes. This is the way things have been sorted out with the government, yeah.
And so what's the reaction amongst ordinary people around the Oldbury area then?
Well, we're rather aghast by it because, I mean, a lot of, right, one example, right, you can imagine Oldbury. Across the river is a place called Tibbenham, which is probably a mile and a half from this particular development. The people over there do not even know what's going on. We're dropping leaflets over there and we're getting people saying to us, my God, we didn't know this was even going to be proposed.
So, but there's already a power station at Oldbury. This isn't really going to make a lot of difference.
It will make a significant difference because the previous, the power station that's there now, yeah, is one hell of a lot smaller, emits a hell of a lot less radiation, and because of the size of it, doesn't need direct, indirect cooling.
Okay, Reg, can you give us an idea of what the scale of this new proposed station is?
It's at least eight times the size of the existing one now, in terms of geographic
size. Which is pretty big, isn't it? It's quite a big site already.
Oh, it's massive, yeah. You're talking covering at least 250 acres, yeah. And massive implication for the towns in the Severn Vale and the environment of the Severn Vale. We have the River Severn and the River Wye. The River Wye was recently voted one of the best, or the best river in the UK. Guess what? We're going to put a nuclear power station directly opposite where it comes out. An even bigger one.
Yeah, but what would you both of you say about the arguments where we're saying actually this is, what we need is different forms of energy that don't pollute the environment, that don't cause climate change? Actually, nuclear is one of the top choices, isn't it?
I think that's what a lot of people are saying now. I think that's what a lot of the industry would like to have us believe. I totally agree with your point that we do need a mix of new energies. I personally just don't believe that nuclear energy should be in the mix. I think we should be looking at a mix of renewables. I think we should be encouraging more energy efficiency, both commercially and domestically. And I just think we need to look at how we use our energy, how we insulate our houses, how we live our lives. A lot of the sort of current estimates of how much energy we're going to need are based around the fact of us just continuing, particularly in the Western world, to use as much energy as we possibly want all the time. There's absolutely no restrictions. And I'm certainly not suggesting we should go back to the dark ages, but I think there's so much that we can be doing, both on a micro level, you know, for ourselves at home, mm-hmm. through to on a grander scale, you know, with industry and as a nation, to be saving energy and to be using the energy that we have far more efficiently. And I think that if the renewables industry had been given as much sort of subsidies and support as the nuclear industry had been given, that would be a lot stronger option. And I think that the nuclear industry is doing a great job greenwashing themselves as a real beautifully carbon emission free clean technology, which it's not. It's dirty, it's risky, it's inherently unsafe. And you mentioned the, you know, we don't want it in our, we're worried about our property prices. Personally, I don't care about that. Well, obviously, well, I probably do, but that's not why I'm here. It's not that I don't want it in my backyard. I don't want it in anybody's backyard. I think it's a fundamentally unsafe industry, and I don't think anybody should have to have it.
Can I just mention one point with regard to the people of Bristol, actually, and the city of Bristol? It's going to be jammed between Hinkley Point and the new Albury site at Chepernine. This, in the latest MPS document from the DEC, from the Department of Energy and Climate Change, it raises the concern about cumulative effects. The current nuclear power stations probably generate 700 or 800 megawatts. These new ones will generate 3,300 megawatts each. You are talking.
So that's about four or five times more.
Yeah.
Well, sure, that's fantastic news.
Fantastic news. I mean, the news.
This is the latest technology, nuclear technology.
It isn't the latest technology. None of these reactors are much better than the ones that were around 20 years ago. Just look at the world's experience at the moment with construction of these things. Okay, China's pushing ahead with it. China is pushing ahead on a massive scale. I think they're proposing 30 reactors very quickly, but that's going to cause us problems in terms of being able to buy uranium. There will then be a shortage of uranium. And the only thing that makes nuclear palatable to the people who want to produce electricity that way is that uranium charges are relatively low. But suddenly get 100 new power stations looking for uranium, you are going to find significant problems.
Now, Abigail, you're not a nuclear expert. You're not a physicist, a scientist. So, I mean, surely you should just leave this to the scientists. Leave it to the physicists and the energy people.
I think you're quite right. I'm not an expert, but I know what I believe. I know what I think is right. I think it's foolish and risky, and it's man's folly. I'm certainly not anti-technology, I think, you know, but I do think it's foolish when something is so inherently dangerous, when really what you're talking about, the results could be catastrophic if it goes wrong. And to that I would add that there is a large body of scientific work out there and evidence out there that nuclear power stations are inherently unsafe, and particularly in terms of both environmental impact around them and the effect on people's health.
But the nuclear industry is incredibly powerful, Abigail. Yeah. It's not, what are you going to do when they just simply say, sorry folk, you can have all the talks you want, discuss as much as you want, but we're going to build it anyway?
Well, I'm just going to do my best to be as vocal as possible, really, and try to encourage other people to find out about it. I'm not asking anyone to necessarily change their minds based on the evidence I give them. I would just encourage them to look into it for themselves. What's interesting about the group that, you know, Reg started down in Shepherdine is it really is, there's a wide variety of people, and they're not all actually anti-nuclear necessarily, or as vehement as I may be in my belief about the nuclear industry, but the more everyone looks into it, the more they come round to my way of thinking and to the anti-nuclear viewpoint.
Can I just make one point with regard to the Department of Energy and Climate Change are having a meeting in Bristol on the 29th of November. Now, if nobody turns up to that in Bristol, then the consultation's finished. They think, deal done. I would suggest that people...
Well, I didn't know that was taking place. Well, I mean, they're hoping that no one will know. Give us the details, please?
The details, I can certainly, if you go to our website, right, okay, we'll be able to direct people to it.
Please give the website.
Website detail is www.shepherdineagainstnuclearenergy.org.uk.
And I'll just give the email address, which is oldbrynuclear@btinternet.com. That's one word, oldbrynuclear@btinternet.com. And the website, shepherdineagainstnuclearenergy.org.uk. And the phone number, 07796 447 880. That's 07796 447 880. 880. Reg and Abigail, thanks ever so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Liberal Democrat Councillor for Easton, John Keeley, and to reporter Marina Morris, and to Martin Summers. Next week, war crimes in Iraq. Was the entire invasion just an elaborate confidence trick? If so, who's to blame? And we have that report from US security expert and retired FBI war crimes prosecutor John Loftus. See you next week.
The community radio station for Bristol, and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.